Welcome along. I'm in a bit of a state of chaos, as you can tell, but we are here, and happy fourth birthday to us. It's the fourth birthday of the Mark Stein Club, and very happy to have you along. And my recitation of the time zones, which I know irritates some people, but it would actually be a little different this time because it is 10 a.m. North American Eastern Time, which is 11 a.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 11:30 a.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador, and beyond the Americas, it is 9 p.m. in London and Dublin, 10 p.m. in Paris and Berlin, 11 p.m. in... Oh, no, no, wait a minute. I've done it all wrong again. I've defaulted to the usual thing. What am I talking about? It's 3 p.m. in London, Dublin, 4 p.m. in Paris and Berlin, 5 p.m. in Istanbul and Jerusalem. I think it's 10 p.m. in Perth and Hong Kong. But don't hold me to that. But now you know, I'm not using any cheat sheets on this. So that's still, that's actually still... done extemporaneously off the top of my head. Thank you anyway for all your kind words about our fourth anniversary. And as I said, we are doing it a little bit differently today, but this is a fourth anniversary Clubland Q&A. And there are some people who love absolutely everything about our club. And don't ask me why, but among them is Richard Moses of California, who says everything about the club is excellent. But I know there are a few people who feel slightly, somewhat differently. And if you are one of them, then do let me know what you don't like. And we might correct what you don't like, or we might tell you to take a hike. It could go either way. Anyway, Chris Hall writes, I very much enjoyed your last Mark Stein show. That was just yesterday, but you make it sound as if it was months back. I very much enjoyed your last Mark Stein show where you kept shouting that people should stop waving the Constitution at you. It reminded me of a... Right, yeah, that was in a rather lengthy disquisition on why everything... Basically on the lack of equality before the law. So basically going from a land of laws to a land of men. And whatever a land of men is, it isn't a republic. So don't wave your republic's constitution at me because we're way beyond that. And Chris says, it reminded me of a rather goofy old Star Trek episode where a primitive tribe called the Yangs, i.e. Yanks, had devolved to the point where their constitution was referred to by the worship words Eid Pleb Nista. Originally, it had been We the People. In a funny way, this episode may have been prescient, as we now have a situation where people worship a document that they no longer seem able to read or understand. Do you think there is a religious devotion to the Constitution without an understanding of the catechism underlying the faith? That's all very well put, I think, Chris. And I put it this, let me put it this way. I said yesterday that every society needs roots. That's as basic as it can get. Otherwise, you're basically Cambodia living in year zero, or you're somewhere such as North Korea, where everything before the hereditary dictatorship has been abolished. And that's a fairly serious defect. And that's why I, at the time of the, I tried to be polite about it, but a couple of weeks back when the Duke of Edinburgh died, and I found almost all commentary from the United States on the monarchy, it reigns over a whole lot of real estate around the planet. I found it not to be terribly useful because, basically, Americans think of the monarchy as just a sort of ceremonial thing. So they think, well, why would you want to hire a bunch of people just to go and cut ribbons at hospitals? It's a complete waste of time. Or to get up to sex shenanigans sufficient to interest the editors of People magazine. And that, of course, is not what the monarchy is. The genius of the system of constitutional monarchy is it locates all power in the absence of power. So that the idea is that the Queen has no power, except, in fact, of course, she has the ultimate power. And that has proved an important factor at various times across the last century, as Canadians in the 1920s could tell you, as Australians in the 1970s could tell you, and as Papua New Guineans could tell you from just 2 or 3 years ago. And you may say, well, you know, so what you're saying is that every 50 years it matters. Yeah, every 50 years it matters, somewhere, Canada, Australia, Papua New Guinea, wherever. And blessed is the system where it only matters every 50 years. Okay, so that's what, so arguments, about the monarchy, I find silly. We don't live in a hyper-rash, life isn't an abstraction. We're not sitting here in 2021 designing a constitutional system for Canada. We've got one, that's what it is. If you demolish it, then you're just playing BLM's game or Antifa's game. And so, of course, what happened in whatever it is now, 240 years ago, is that a bunch of British settlers in the American colonies decided nuts to the crown. And didn't necessarily have to be like that, but it was like that. So once you've done that, you have to put something in its place as the transcendent equivalent, the roots, the mystic cords, what binds a society. And in a certain sense, Americans created a constitution, the greatest written constitution in the world back then and for many years after. But here we are, as I suggested yesterday, living in a post-constitutional order. And then the fact becomes, and here's the danger. You know, the catechism underlying the faith. As I said, the reality is British settlers threw off the British crown. So they're British settlers who threw off the British crown. That's the reality of what happened. And so imbuing the Constitution with, as the mystic cords of memory, as the transcendent historical roots of the society, can in a certain way impede your clarity about the nation you built here. So we have the idea that America is the so-called proposition nation, that if you're interested in liberty, America is the place for you because it's the Constitution founded on liberty. Now, that's all very interesting, but that's not actually how people think of their country. In most places around the world, Finland is just where Finns happen to live. Sweden is just where Swedes happen to live. Tajikistan is where Tajiks happen to live. Whatever. But if you imbue a nation with a mystical purpose, you can't be surprised then when fashions change and other generations attempt to hijack that constitution to pervert that purpose, which is what's gone on the left. And what's interesting to me, always interesting to me, Chris, and this is really something we could do a whole we could probably do a whole college course on it. But what's interesting to me is how even many people on the right pervert the reality. So, for example, we have this thing, oh, nation of immigrants. You know, that isn't what America started out as. As I said, they were just British settlers. They were British subjects moving from one corner of George III's dominions to another corner of George III's dominions. That's internal settlement within His Majesty's realm. That's not immigrant. Whatever that is, that is an immigration. So the whole nation of immigrants thing is a bit specious. And what happens then is what we see now, that when George W. Bush returns to politics, to intervene in politics, suddenly he's talking up. He's a conservative. But suddenly he's talking up this nation of immigrants as the be-all and end-all of America. And as we can see, the minute you start talking in that lingo, which I regard as radical leftist lingo, as radical as anything, really, because it says that a nation isn't its people, however defined. It basically said it's a nation is whoever can get here and stick a foot on American soil. It's very bizarre, that. It's very bizarre. And I, you know, I respect, I sort of said a bit of this when I was at Hillsdale the other day. And I put it this way, that, you know, the crisis is Western civilization sliding off a cliff. So it doesn't matter whether you've got a constitution, as America has, or you've got no written constitution, as the United Kingdom has, or you've got 57 different constitutions in the last century and a half, as the French have. We're all sliding off a cliff, and I think we should all try not to slide off the cliff together, because if most of us slide off the cliff, but one or two don't, we're still done for. But the point of the whole Western civilization going off the cliff is this is a civilizational phenomenon. And I also would say this, that there was a time when an appeal to the Constitution, of the kind that constitutional conservatives make, was heard. But we now live in an era where, to the majority of Americans under 50, I would say, we could probably poll this if you disagree on that, but to the majority of Americans under 50, the Constitution as a defining instrument has no purchase on them. To the left, it's an obstacle. You want to blow it up in certain respects, to get rid of the right to bear arms, to get rid of freedom of speech, to get rid of freedom of religion, to get rid of the Electoral College, to get rid of a Senate that gives each state two senators, even if they've only got 500,000 people, like Wyoming and Vermont. So that's why I don't feel, there are people who can tell you all, you know, and I'm sure many Americans listening will point out, well, you got this wrong, you got that wrong, and all the rest of it. The point is, I think we're beyond that now, Chris. We are in a crisis, and we're beyond that. And there are places you can go to where they want to talk about the Constitution all day long. But right now, the issue is that the dominant political forces in this country, including, I would estimate, a huge proportion of the judges sworn to uphold that Constitution when constitutional claims come before them, do not buy it. That's just my two bits on this day, but I gave you a little bit of a background, and one final thought, by the way. All constitutions, you know, the Westminster system, which is what we have in Canada and the British West Indies and all the rest of it, assumes the behaviour of gentlemen. Nothing is written down because it's all codes and conventions, and it assumes the behaviour of gentlemen. And there have been places in the Commonwealth where there have not been gentlemen, and in big ways and small ways, they've managed to ride a coach and horses through a Westminster Constitution. Now, the American system, everything's written down, all the checks and balances and it's all spelled out there in the Constitution. But it still assumes the behavior of gentlemen. Unless it's a fake constitution like the Soviet constitution or the North Korean constitution or Saddam Hussein's constitution, if it's a real constitution, it assumes the behavior of gentlemen. That is, that all constitutions are fit only for moral people. And if you are no longer a moral people, if you are depraved in significant ways, mentioning no names, then the Constitution isn't much aid. So that's my thoughts on that. Johnny, and I mean that because, you know, if you again, the flagrant, they'll just go back to all this election shenanigans. The Constitution couldn't be plainer. Or making the District of Columbia a state. You can say there are nuances and there are emanations from the penumbra and everything, but the US Constitution is quite clear. It's not just that states determine election systems, it's state legislatures. So that's pretty clear, and yet judges ignored it. It's also pretty clear that the District of Columbia cannot be a state, and yet do you really want to bet on how many of those 9 judges on the Supreme Court are going to ignore that? Anyway, as I said, we should probably do a whole college course on that. Johnny B. writes, "Hi, Mark. I very much enjoyed yesterday's talk, covering, as always, a wealth of subjects. May I add the following. May the 5th is also the anniversary of the start of the Peninsular War, following Napoleon forcing Ferdinand VII to abdicate in favour, somewhat indirectly, of himself in 1808. That's true. During this war at the Battle of Coruña, Napoleon certainly knew that, and I would imagine it was present in his mind as he lay dying on St. Helena. During this war, the British army escaped from Spain more or less intact thanks to the Royal Navy, sadly losing its commander, Sir John Moore, at the moment of victory. His burial was commemorated in the poem by Charles Wolfe, which ends with the lines, "We carved not a line and we raised not a stone, but left him alone with his glory." This brings us neatly back to your poem by Isaac McClellan, which I assume copied Wolfe's poem for its final line. I think it alluded to it. I think that's the best way. Wolfe's poem might be an interesting read for one of your poems of the week. We'll take that under consideration. It is a fine poem. When you came to mention Northern Ireland later today, you may have read that the BBC aired a poll which showed 49% of the population wanting a united Ireland. They neglected to mention that the polling organisation they cited apparently advertises for people willing to be polled, thus enabling the BBC to arrive at the 49% groundswell instead of the more usually quoted polling figures of around 29% wanting reunification. Shades of the Brexit and Scottish independence polls there, don't you think? Best wishes, John. Yes, I do. You know, the determining, or not the determining factor, but certainly a big part of polls in Northern Ireland is Catholic nationalists, so-called, who do not wish to be part of United Ireland. It's always been a factor. No one's quite sure why it's a factor. But that is actually a critical element of all polling in Northern Ireland. That said, I do think loyalism is, unionism is as demoralized as I have ever known it at the moment. I think I said this after swinging by Belfast and Derry a couple of years ago. And I think the reason for that is that it's complicated by the fact that so-called loyalists nevertheless wish Northern Ireland were still in the European Union and various other factors, and by the more general sense that the United Kingdom as a political unit may have outlived its usefulness. I think that's the other thing people forget sometimes, is that you can get together for certain purposes and then those things don't particularly matter anymore. And at some point you think, well, wait a minute, what are we all doing still together? And that's very difficult to reverse once it takes hold. And so you have, I think, a certain paradox in Northern Ireland, is that in that poll is rubbish and there are no takers in serious measure for the convulsions of Irish unification. But at the same time, loyalism is a little demoralised. And I know, There's lots of people listening to this. We have a lot of Mark Stein Club members. We have a lot of other listeners to our shows in Northern Ireland. They'll say, well, what do you know? When was the last time you were in Carrickfergus? It's all changed since you were there 18 months ago or whatever. Anyway, thank you. Thank you for that. Mark Kelly writes, congratulations on the fourth anniversary of the Mark Stein Club. I joined on May the 9th. 2017, and still regret not joining on the first day. You will bear that humiliation for the rest of your life, Mark. There's nothing that can be done about it. We can't go back and change history. You left it 3 days to join. We know your kind. Shilly-shallyers. Mark adds, thank you for everything. None the less. Stefan Erle writes, dear Mark, thanks for creating this club. In the last 4 years, you've brought lots of clarity on issues and meaning through your cultural content. Let me ask my first question on Q&A about the most important issue of our time, China. I have all the reasons in the world to hate the Chinese Communist Party. First, part of my family used to live in East Germany, behind the Iron Curtain. Second, I live in Taiwan and wish to continue to live free. And I do hate Xi's regime for the threat it represents for Taiwan, Asia, and for the liberties he curtails in China and Hong Kong. However, from a human and conservative point of view, I am glad that China has lifted almost 1 billion people out of poverty and made lots of Chinese very rich. Only socialists envy the success and wealth of other people. I think that the CCP did a wonderful job, and they did so thanks to capitalism, education, a stable currency. Instead of criticizing China for its success and power, shouldn't you put more blame on the Western governments who created so many regulations and had such high welfare that it chased its industry away at an even faster pace than before? Or another way of putting it, would China be such a threat if the US and Europe had pursued a less socialized path in the last 30 years? We all hope China becomes a democracy one day, but right now, when the Chinese look at BLM, transgender nuttiness, open borders, the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice, woke Twitter, maybe they feel our system isn't so much superior. We should be a better example. That is a brilliant question, Stefan. Actually, very, very brilliant, because my criticisms of China are, in absolute terms, they're nothing to do with comparisons with the modern West, which is largely indefensible and entirely risible. And just to go through, but nevertheless, there are concerning things about China. Just to go through what you've been talking about. You say that China has lifted almost 1 billion people out of poverty and made lots of Chinese very rich. I would slightly dispute that. We did that, but by which I mean Americans and Europeans and Australians and all the other parts of the world that basically outsourced global manufacturing to the People's Republic of China. So we're not talking here, and this is where I don't think the rise of China will not be written about as a natural phenomenon in the history books, because it's not like the industrial competition between Britain, America, and Germany in the 19th century, where you have nations building in internal markets and then growing companies that export around the world and sell around the planet. What you're talking about here is an artificial system in which the United States, in particular, the Chamber of Commerce, right, in particular, decided to send all American manufacturing to China. That's not what happened. When you look at the rivalry in the late 19th century, that's not how America became top dog economically. What happened in America is that people worked hard in America, built global companies in America, and simply did better at the same game than Germany or Britain did. Now, what's going on in China is entirely different. Now, you're quite correct. You say that shouldn't you put more blame on the Western governments who created so many regulations and had such high welfare that it chased its industry away at an even faster pace than before? You're right. We have over-regulated our economies to the point where I was talking about this. I think I've talked about it here with reference to my former New York employee, a delightful lady called Catherine, and the amount, I forget what it was that Catherine got paid, but to put a relatively modest amount of money in an American's pocket, you also have to pay an enormous sum on top of that in terms of government regulation of employment and of the workspace and everything, none of which applies in China. And this is before we get into employing actual slave labor, as people like Nike do. So, yes, it goes on. All the woke people demanding protections for this and that worker and protections for workers on environmental regulations. All these people are doing, ensuring there'll be fewer and fewer American workers and more Chinese workers. And the people who do that, who lay off the American workers and replace them with Chinese workers, will still be bleating, virtue-signaling humbugs who demand even more regulation at home. Now, then you go on to say, but when the Chinese look at BLM, transgender nuttiness, open borders, the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice, woke Twitter, maybe they feel our system isn't so much superior. And again, that is inarguable. I've said throughout the last year or whatever it is now that China has the advantage of being a conventional ethno-national power. It's got 1.4 billion people, over a billion of whom belong to the same ethnic group. So it's, and the people who aren't in that group, like the Uyghurs, are nothing. Nobody pretends that, you know, nobody's doing Uyghur Lives Matter. Nobody's talking about systemic racism keeping the Uyghurs down, although there is systemic racism. But nobody's saying, oh, well, you know, we need more positive Uyghur role models on Chinese TV. We need to get more Uyghur weather girls out there on Chinese TV. And we need to have more Uyghurs in the movies and the sitcoms. They don't waste their time with it. That's before you get to the transgender rubbish. That's before you get to the open borders, the George W. Bush nation of immigrants rubbish. I mean, over a billion people who belong to an homogenous ethnic group. So they don't have identity politics that set different groups against each other with the state as mediator, because you need a powerful state to mediate the competing group interests of gays and Muslims and Hispanics. You know, that's they just think like old school great powers do. And that is a huge advantage to them. They're laughing at us because there's been no civilizational collapse like that, like this in history. And you have it they Biden comes in and they think, oh yes, what a Biden. Let's see what he does. And they watch him standing up at those stupid press conferences announcing that he's shattering another glass ceiling and it's going to be the first transgender Muslima to be Deputy Assistant Undersecretary of the Interior. And they're thinking, what the hell is this crap? You know, I don't even know. I may have got that wrong. I don't know whether and it's actually quite hard to find a transgender Muslima, but maybe they could persuade John Kerry to take one for the team or take two for the team. That's all nonsense. It's the most trivial civilizational collapse ever. And you're right to say we should be a better example. What we should be doing is actually thinking like conventional nation states, because that's how China's thinking, and they're kicking our butt. Bart Nielsen says, waiting with bated breath for the show to begin, please do give the rundown of what time it is in all the various locales. I always tune in for that part and then my eyes glaze over for... Yeah, it's all downhill from there. You're absolutely right, Bart. Bart's eyes glaze over after the recitation of the time zones and that has certainly caused some of the problems. Thank you for that, Bart. Very, very nice to hear from you, and thank you for your congratulations. Michael Cavino says, congratulations, Mark. The club just seems to be getting better and better. You have been a lifesaver for us during this pandemic. Picking up on your Bond-themed show from last week, what is your favourite Bond film and why? Because it's one of those, my friend Anthony Lane, who I worked with at The Independent many years ago, and then he became the film critic of The New Yorker. Anthony says people love everything about the James Bond films. They love the music, they love the pre-title sequence, they love the graphics, the dolly birds twirling around the guns, they love the byplay between Bond and Moneypenny. What they don't love is James Bond films, as he put it, because no Bond film quite lives up to all those. The whole isn't greater than the sum of the parts, was his argument. And I've said, you know, I don't like the last 20 minutes where they're running around the hollowed out volcano, shooting all the extras in the golf carts, trying to get to the big button that switches off the laser that's going to zap New York and London and Moscow or whatever it is and plunge the world into war. That bit is always boring as hell. So I said I liked Sky. I like a Bond film with a good song. I like a Bond film with some human emotion in, and I like all the sexual byplay too, and I would probably come up with a merger of them. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, for example, I liked, even though it doesn't have a song, it only has music during the titles, and I don't particularly care for George Lazenby, but if I could have the plot of On Her Majesty's Secret Service with Sean Connery and then Goldfinger or Diamonds Are Forever as the title song, and I could have the... I definitely want to have Lois Maxwell as Moneypenny. It's all getting too complicated. I thought it would be a simple question, but it's all getting too difficult. Scott Scherzer says, dear Mark, I've been a club member from the beginning. And have enjoyed every minute. You make the waning of Western civilization quite entertaining. I don't need to list all the pathologies that currently plague us and continue to lead us to ruin. Please just provide your best guess as to the possibility of exiting this process and returning to a traditional way of life. Well, this goes back to what I was saying, I think, last week. I'm beyond... You know, and I get asked, oh, who do you like for 2022? What do you think we'll retake the house? Okay, so we retake. So as Newt said to me the other day on telly, don't worry, because in 2022, in 2022, Kevin McCarthy's going to be back, going to be leader of the house, and Mitch McConnell's going to be back as Senate Majority Leader. Then what? Because actually, didn't Republicans have total control just 4 years ago? And it wasn't, even if you take a general, and there was pushback when I said there was nothing but the Paul Ryan tax cut, there was pushback on that, on how that had liberated the economy and all the rest of it. And I'm all about urgency now, and urgency means actually acknowledging the. For example, I think it was just yesterday. It's been announced that American birth rates have collapsed to European levels, 1.6, I think 1.67, which at the time I wrote America Alone Sweden and Denmark and so on had 1.6, and then you get to Germany, it's 1.4, and you get to Greece and Italy and Spain, and it's 1.3, which is what that's deathbed demography, from which no society has ever recovered. So American birth rates have collapsed in the 15 years since I wrote America Alone. That's a European birth rate, 1.67. 1.67. And that isn't... That's an example of what I mean by the lack of urgency. The lack of urgency. You know, we just can't... We're not talking about anything that matters. And actually, the tax cut, I would say, isn't going to do it. I should try and tie that in, because we had a... Oh, yeah, here we are. Dale Owen says, "Dear Mark, surely it's time, finally, to take off the gloves and drive out the corporatists inside the GOP, and indeed all those of the same ilk in nominally conservative parties across the West. We need a realignment of politics based on social and cultural issues. Life is not a mere derivative of economics. What do you think?" Now, this is Dale Owens, who is a Welshman living near Milan in Italy. That doesn't narrow it down very much, because there are millions of Welshmen living in the greater Milan area. I hate it when you go in to have, a nice little espresso in a traditional Italian cafe, and all you hear from the surrounding tables is Welsh. It's so annoying. Anyway, Dale is a Welshman living near Milano, and he makes an excellent point to go back to America Alone, I said Homo economicus isn't enough, because that's not where... I'm getting all worked up now. It's like when I was yelling about not waving the Constitution. Just let me do a Marco Rubio and have a sip of water. Thank you about that. Got a little Welsh tickle in the back of my throat now, getting so worked up about the Welshman demographically sweeping Milan. But Dale makes a point I made in America Alone. Homo economicus is not where we live. So when you have conservatives just talking in fiscal terms, that isn't conservatism. The Wall Street Journal isn't conservatism, because it's all... And it hasn't worked out. You know, what happened was, for example, in Yorkshire, the British were told that they needed people to come and operate the mills, and to be taxi drivers, and to be nurses in hospitals. Well, all those mills and factories closed anyway, but the people who had come from Pakistan were still there. And so the mills and the factories went away, but the mosques and madrasas went up. Well, what's important to someone? You know, if you have a system where there's not enough people to work in your mill, maybe you should let the mill close, or maybe you should recognise you've got some kind of a problem, and you should provide some incentives, whether through mechanisation or natalist policies, to ensure that you do have people or machines to work in the mill. But social and cult, what's more important? Those immigrants don't think of themselves as mill. Those people who came to work in the mill, who came to work in the factory, they don't think of themselves as mill workers or factory. A man doesn't, if it's a choice between defining himself as a Muslim or as a bus driver, he doesn't. Nobody defines themselves as a bus driver. And so you have cultural transformation, where you now have millions of people, and this underlay both Trump, and it underlay Brexit, and it underlay Marine Le Pen's rise in France, and all kinds of other things. People who feel foreigners in their own home. And when Dale says we need a realignment of politics based on social and cultural issues, in a certain sense, that's taken place on the continent. The way I put it was, I always thought it was ridiculous when you had so-called, people always wanted moderate Republicans, like Schwarzenegger, like Christy Whitman in New Jersey, like George Pataki in New York, like Bill Weld in Massachusetts. These so-called, aren't they nice, these moderate Republicans? And what that meant was that they would be fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. And now for a start, that's not... The social liberalism generally costs an awful lot of money, so it's difficult. When the fiscal conservatism meets the social liberalism generally wins. But also, it's not where the real divide is. If you look at what's happened in Europe, you've seen the emergence of what you might call fiscally liberal parties. That's to say, they don't disturb the general understanding of the post-war welfare state. They don't want to challenge that in any big way. But at the same time, they're culturally conservative, because that's the thing, is that people are basically creeped out by the fact that they're living in bewildering, massive, turbulent social change, and they're just expected to go along with it. And I tend to agree with you, Dale. I don't think that's the issue for most people. By the way, I may say that most of the fiscal conservatism, whether it's done at the way it's being done at America, where you're basically maxing out the credit. My joke was, you're maxing out the credit cards of your unborn grandchildren. Actually, we've blown through everything the grandkids will have, so we're maxing out the credit cards of our great-great-grandkids. And as we see from those birth rates, 1.67, those great-great-grandkids are never going to be born. And by the time they should have been born, the United States is going to be out of business. So that this so-called fiscal conservatism is really not a good thing. Evan Osborne, thank you for that. Evan Osborne, Evan is a very Welsh name too. Is this Dale's next door neighbour in Milan? Anyway, Evan Osborne says, happy birthday. I'd like to escape the civilizational collapse colloquy for a bit. Good luck with that, and ask you about musical theatre. You know, Evan, if you haven't yet seen Civilizational Collapse the Musical, you really should. It's a cracking show. My 19-year-old daughter loves musical theatre, but I never have been a fan. I don't dislike it, it's just never been my thing. I would like to be able to talk about it intelligently with her. Thus, two questions. What do you think is the future of musical theatre, both on and off stage? It seems to clueless me to be barreling headlong toward complete Disneyfication, which on general principles I would think lamentable. Second, what works from the past would you recommend she become familiar with, and why? I love the 100 Years Ago show, says Evan, and would love to see you do more with it. Well, I have been thinking about how to do more with it. Thank you for that, Evan. I like the 100 Years Ago show too, and as you notice, we've given a little bit more prominence. We've given it its own slot on Sunday, and so it's a kind of spin-off now from the Mark Steyn show. It is to the Mark Steyn show as Rhoda or Lou Grant is to the Mary Tyler Moore show. That's how I think of it. You say, what works from the past would you recommend she become familiar? Well, I'll answer your question first about barreling towards complete Disneyfication. Yeah, musicals change. You know, there was American musical comedy in the 20s and 30s. And then there became the American musical play, which is the more serious stuff like Carousel, Rodgers and Hammerstein, or My Fair Lady, Lerner and Lowe, Fiddler on the Roof in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, heyday of the American musical play. And then that all got a bit of exhausted. And the 80s, the British took over with what are really kind of not rock operas so much as rock operettas, really, I guess you'd call them, Les Miserables and The Phantom of the Opera and that kind of thing. And then they all got a bit tapped out, and we have now just these so-called jukebox musicals where people take 30 Carole King songs and stick a show. You know, the blockbuster example of that is, of course, ABBA. Mamma Mia. That's a different kind of thing. And then you have musicals adapted from films, which is not a natural. That's a sign of a medium in decline, because the natural trajectory of a story is to go from a novel to a play to a film. So when you have it the other way around, where they're taking any old film, Groundhog Day or Legally Blonde or whatever, and just taking a film and turning it into that offends against the natural order, which is from the book to the stage to the screen. So that is that's an issue for me, and God knows. You know, what's going to, if they ever switch the lights back on Broadway, God knows what's ever going to come back. But I like it. I like telling a story through song. I enjoy that. It doesn't, the same people who say to me, you know, Stein, I just can't buy the music. It's not natural. It's not natural for somebody to be walking down the street and then bursting into song with a full orchestra behind them. That's just not real. I can't buy it. It's not real. Oh, yeah, but you buy like a man turning into a great big supersized giant green Hulk and ripping a tear in the space-time continuum and battling Loki, the Norse god of evil, in the skies in the CGI battle scene for 20 minutes, which is as boring as the James Bond golf cart finale. You buy all that, but you can't buy a guy walking down the street who's just fallen in love and is singing a song about how thrilled to be in love again he is. But you'll buy a bunch of guys flying round the sky in the most ridiculous long underwear, which you would never wear to fly around the sky in. Okay, while we're doing all the big picture stuff as well, I'll tell you what, I'll do a... because this was, I was thinking about this the other day. I can't remember which superhero it was now, but they're going to make him. He was a straight guy, and then they decided he was a straight white guy, but they decided then they might make him gay, and then he was going to be Hispanic or whatever it is. And I suddenly realized how weird it is now, is that the dominant. And this is really important, actually, and is really essential, I think, to our civilizational collapse. The dominant form of storytelling now is by corporations. Okay, so think about Facebook. You don't like Facebook or Twitter because they kick off conservatives. You don't like Delta and Coca-Cola because they intervened in the Georgia election laws. Well, you know. Imagine a corporation that writes a nation's stories, the stories a society tells itself. That's what Disney and Marvel do, basically for the entirety of the planet now. So we have corporately created, you know, all societies have myths, and the myths are rooted in how that society thinks of itself. But they are given form by individuals. So they're given form by novelists or playwrights or, you know, J.K. Rowling, whatever you make about Harry Potter, it's hers. It's hers. And one of the reasons why people criticize her for her alleged transphobia is because they've been taught to think of it as not hers, that somehow there's a man, there's a vice president at Warner Brothers who, if he wants to, can punish J.K. Rowling by making Harry Potter trans. And that would show that nasty transphobic J.K. Rowling. And the reason we've gotten into this is because we now have stories written by corporations. So, whatever it is now, 80-something years ago at DC Comics, Bill Kane and Bob Kane and Bill Finger created Batman, and Joe Siegel, whatever they are, created Superman and all the rest of it. And then Stan Lee and a couple of other guys came along and created all the Marvel guys in the 1960s. Now, they were works for hire, which is why a lot of those great comic book artists world famous, ended up nevertheless broke because they created their characters for a corporation. But nevertheless, even within that corporation, there was the sense of just a few human beings creating characters. Now we have the most powerful corporations on Earth. That's why they think, that's why you get this rubbish like, oh, James Bond, should he be black next time, or should he be Muslim, or should he be lesbian? And it's all rubbish. Ian Fleming created James Bond, and it's Ian Fleming's James Bond that you're making a film of. And if you don't like that guy, get off your ass and create your own character. And create your Muslim transgender MI6 agent who's better than James Bond. But this idea, again, it's the perversion. It's the perversion of how to think about anything that has gone on in our society that now leads to sane people writing columns, speculative columns for respectable publications on whether it's time to make Spider-Man a lesbian. This is corporate art, which is the antithesis of art. So I am with Dale Owens that I think the conservative, there's nothing conservative. That's actually, you know, as I always say, if you haven't heard my adaptation of George Orwell's 1984, you should, because he predicted everything. There, the state actually writes the novels. The state creates the art within its ideologically acceptable bounds. All that has happened in America is that the state has outsourced the propaganda to woke corporations like Disney. So now we're in Disneyland. They're saying, oh, well, we can't have Sleeping Beauty and the Prince, because the Prince kisses Sleeping Beauty and wakes her from her sleep. And he didn't obtain consent from her before he kissed her. No, I think that's what you call the kiss of life, you idiots. But this idea that, so the corporations now, we have corporations writing our stories, which is one reason why we're dead. Martha McNeely wrote, Mark, have you ever appeared in a panto performance? If you've never seen an English pantomime, and many of our listeners in various outposts of the Commonwealth will have seen them. They used to come through Toronto. I don't suppose they do now because they're insufficiently woke. But there's nothing like a great English, he's behind you! And actually, they're very trans-friendly, or they were. The principal boy is always played by the girl, Marty Webb, who is a great chum of Don Black's, and Don and Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote Tell Me on a Sunday for her. But Marty I saw years ago, I think at the Palladium in London, as a wonderful thigh-slapping principal boy. And and then on the other hand, you have the pantomime Dame, who is always played by a man. And it probably is all, you know, cultural trans appropriation or something now. But I would love to appear in Panto. I think I'd be happy to shave my beard and be a pantomime dame, Martha. Thank you for that. Philip Porstian is to E as well. There's one sub. We might take you up on that, actually, because that is a timely tale for Tales for Our Time. But then he also says, will you have a printed version of The Prince of Windsor available? This was the story we did last summer, the contemporary inversion of The Prisoner of Zender. And Philip says, paperback, hardback, PDF, ebook, whatever. He says, I loved your performance, but would also like to be able to reread it and give it to select friends. Well, thank you for that, Philip. We have had an enormous, enormous number of questions and requests for the same thing, for a hardback or paperback version of The Prisoner of Windsor. And I think we will take you up on that. Michael J. from Colorado writes, happy birthday to us, Mark. One of the best investments I've ever made. I would like your opinion on whether Trump should be holding rallies and run again in 2024. I say no. Did I vote for Trump? Yes. Did I approve of most everything he accomplished? Yes. Do I believe in my heart the election was stolen? Yes. All that said, it's time for him to get off the stage, stop sucking the oxygen out of the room, and allow new faces to emerge. There's no one better at being one's own worst enemy. And at this most critical juncture, I don't want him to be the same for the opposition to our now socialist government. Well, look, I wouldn't presume to advise Donald J. Trump on this. As you know, I wasn't terribly happy with the 2020 campaign, and I loved the 2016 candidate. It's his call, and he has the right to do that, given what he accomplished, and also given the fact that the election was stolen from him, because I happen to agree with that too. And if I'd won the election and had it stolen from me, I'd certainly want to make sure I got my revenge on the guys who did that to me. I'd probably be focused on that. The thing about it is, it's hard being the king across the water in Mar-a-Lago. You know, power drains very quickly. And so the challenge for Donald Trump, and I emphasize this is his call, but the challenge for him as a practical matter, Michael, is that he has to retain his brand at its present level all the way through to 2024. Can he do that? How does he do that? Those are all difficult questions, because one minute you're there, and then the next minute you're not there, and then time goes by and people get used to you being not there. And that's the challenge for him. I don't really think about new faces. Again, it goes back to my urgency thing. It also goes back to that Milton Friedman line. You don't wait for the right people to do the right thing. You create the conditions by which the wrong people are obliged to do the right thing, just because, you know, in the way that, say, Bernie Sanders is very good on gun rights in Vermont for the 30 years he's been running statewide in Vermont, he's been stronger on gun rights than many Republicans in, well, for example, in the neighboring state of New York State. So, because in Vermont, the conditions with respect to guns are such that the wrong people are forced to do the right thing. Now, we have to learn from that and actually do that for other things, to transgender issues. Right now, the right people are obliged to do the wrong thing. So we have these rock-rigged conservatives who just, like that idiot from the impeachment trial years ago, is now the governor in Arkansas. So he lives in a red state, but he's not man enough. He's not man enough to resist the trans madness. And that's why we have to work in all these other areas to create the conditions by which the wrong people are forced to do the right thing. Minnie from Minnesota writes, "Good morning, Mark, and congratulations. I was wondering if you think the coronavirus crisis is ever going to end in Democrat states. Is this a crisis that they will never let go to waste and never..." Yeah, that's the famous line, of course, never let a crisis go to waste. But better yet is if you can create the permanent emergency. Again, as I say, that's what 1984 is largely about, the permanent emergency. If you can create the permanent emergency, it's immensely useful. Now, we thought we had a public health crisis a year ago. But what's interesting is all the non-health aspects of it that have been related. And I mean, from everything, from the fact that there's been a massive transfer of power from the individual to the state bureaucracy. So if you're a bureaucrat, if you're a teacher, If you're an official in the Department of Paperwork, this has been a fantastic year for you. And if you are someone who has a small business, you're either out of business or you're a ward of the state. It's been a disaster for you. And then we have the, and again, in terms of small business, in terms of business, it's been a massive transfer of the market from small business to these mega global corporations like Amazon, which have become massively more profitable just because there's no corner store anymore. So you go online and order from Amazon. So again, a massive transfer. And then this psychological thing, this is, which again is the weirdest thing, the fetishization of masks that have become peculiarly, they've gone from just being something, oh, wait a minute, we're entering what's supposedly supposed to be a sanitized zone, so I have to wear a mask here, to becoming something you now wear in the open air as a sign of your compliance or your veneration of science. So you demonstrate how scientific you are with a fetish object, which is itself bizarre, but which I think, so I think someone made this point in the comments recently, and I think it's a point I made back when this started, that I really don't like masks because they belong to low social trust society. You know, the whole thing, the way we used to do things, our social rituals. Oh, here's a man coming towards me. He's smiling at me and his arm is outstretched to shake my hand. That's from high social trust societies. Now, maybe that shaking hands spreads diseases and what have you. But again, if you were looking at it in non-narrow terms, what does it mean to lower social trust? I so miss smiles. I miss noses. I don't like being served. I don't like waitresses whose noses I can't see. Yes, I know people are saying, well, that's the least. Millions of people have got this thing and all you're concerned about is you can't see the nose of the person who's putting your Dover sole down on your table for lunch. Well, it's not. Yes, it's a small thing, but in a way it's not a small thing. And again, who does a diminution of social trust? Who does it advantage? It advantages the state. Again, the fact that we lead less real life now, so we spend more time doing this where we're online and we spend less time interacting with people. When the internet came in, I expressed misgivings about it a lot. So we're going back to the mid-90s now. And so, yes, it's like all very convenient to go to, go online and order everything. But people who, you know, don't interact with the clerk at the general store on a regular basis, I wonder, you know, the isolation, which I think is a huge problem for people who've grown up in the social media era, and you combine it with the mass, and when they go out, you then diminish the possibility of social interaction by making people wear masks. Now, you say, Minnie, do you think this, they're never going to let this end? Well, I think they're going to keep it going for as long as they can because it advantages them. And I was mocked for calling it like a sort of secular burqa, but I think that's, I think there is something, you know, I'm now going, because you occasionally you'll be walking along the street in certain parts of, almost any European city. You'll be walking along the street in Rotterdam and there'll be some covered lady and you'll be, What a shimmeringly exotic, appealing bit of Islamototty that is. I wonder what it would be like to get her home and get her out of the burqa. And of course, you'll never know about that. But the idea of a society where we're not open to each, you know, where we're not open to each other, where we veil ourselves, you know, to have created a kind of secular hijab that we all wear, I think is one of the most, and I don't believe it's going away anywhere, actually. And I mean, it will be, it's not going to be, you know, if you're in the middle of northern New Hampshire, you're not going to be troubled by it. But in a lot of big cities, this stuff is not going to be going away. Let's see, I'll take one more. Brian Dixon said, that I thought that was a good one to end on, but I'll say, let's see this. Brian Dixon says, hi, Mark. I'm a relatively new member, having signed up in February this year. You are a new member, Brian. We're glad to have you along. It was my birthday present to myself on the 16th of February. Well, happy birthday for February the 16th. You say, I've been following you online several years. Last year, I listened to your shows repeatedly while I was working on home projects. Your humour, historical explanations, music and poems had kept me sane through the lockdown. I've read America Alone and After America. In both books, you have accurately forecast the events 10 years forwards from the point of writing. Well, I regret, actually, I'm a bit shocked by the fact that America now has basically a European level birth rate. And as I said, when you take into account the level of immigration here and the higher fertility rates of immigrant communities, you have got to bet that actually, you know, anyone who's been here two or three generations are basically in the same place birth rate wise as the Germans and the Greeks and the Japanese. And that's something that I thought America would manage to resist. With the uncertain state of the world today due to COVID-19, a confident and increasingly aggressive China, and a much divided and weakened America, are you able to provide an insight into where you think we will be in 10 years' time? I think the answer to that is absent urgent change, kaput. Kaput. Because we're not serious. Because we're talking about rubbish all the time. We're talking about Confederate statues you know, we're distracted by piffle, and we have and our entire public discourse is largely fraudulent, which is why there's no point participating, you know, all systemic racism and all the rest of it. Yeah, you know, the past is what the past is. It's Orwellian to think you can rewrite it. It's also Orwellian to destroy it. And so the fact of the matter is that as long as you're having a dishonest public conversation, you're never going to correct the things you need to correct. And as we discussed earlier in the show, the dominant global power is a country untroubled by all the garbage with which America obsesses. Maybe I'll take one more, but getting a little dry in the throat here. I tell you what, I'll come back and talk in a couple of minutes, but just as a birthday treat to me from my cat album, Feline Groovy Songs for Swinging Cats, here is that classic song, The Cat Came Back.
Now old Mr. Johnson had troubles of his own. He had a yellow cat, wouldn't leave the guy alone. He tried how he tried to give that cat away. Gave him to a man who drove off in his Chevrolet. But the cat came back the very next day. The cat came back, they thought he was a goner. But the cat came back, he just wouldn't stay away.
He's back.
Gave him to some ne'er-do-well with a dollar note. Told the boy to take him up the river in a boat. He tied a stone around the cat, it must have weighed 10 pound. And now they drag the river for the poor wee lad who drowned. But the cat came back the very next day. Yes, the cat came back, they thought he was a goner. But the cat came back, he wouldn't stay away.
He's back.
The farmer around the corner swore he'd kill the cat that night. He loaded up his shotgun with nails and dynamite. He waited how he waited for the cat to come around. 90 27 pieces of the guy is all they found. But the cat came back the very next day. Yes, the cat came back. They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back. He wouldn't stay away.
Cat's back. He's back.
Gave him to a traveling man who put him in a sack and promised that he'd tie him to the nearest railroad track. First the train hit the curve, then it jumped the rail, and not a soul was left behind to tell the gruesome tale. But the cat came back the very next day. Yes, the cat came back. They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back. Wouldn't stay away.
He's back.
Johnson went to North Korea, saw that dictatorial kook, who said, I'll stick the cat in front of my outgoing nuke. And off the rocket flew with that old cat securely trussed, and the presidential palace was reduced to toxic dust. But the cat came back the very next day. Yes, the cat came back. They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back. Wouldn't stay away.
He's back.
So he sold the cat in Wall Street, where all the smart folk live, and they leveraged him to refinance a subderivative. The market crashed, the dollar died, economy got hosed, and poor old Mr. Johnson had his property foreclosed. But the cat came back the very next day. Yes, the cat came back. They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back. He wouldn't stay away. Yes, the cat came back, he's here to stay. Yes, he got that place for 10 cents on the dollar. Let old Johnson stay, but keeps him out in the barn. And that is the end of our yarn.
Bad cat, he's back.
And that's from my cat album, Feline Groovy Songs for Swinging Cats, with Kevin and the band and Jan, Emma and Mary doing a splendid job on backing vocals on that old children's song. The what's going on?
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.
That's all. That's all true. I'm going to be sis a bit technically here. As you know, I mentioned a couple of weeks back that I'm driving a desk due to our audio engineer Joe got taken ill a few weeks back, and I've been driving a desk for the first time in decades. And so that is all true about the fact that this is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and all rights are reserved. But I thank you very much for joining me on our fourth birthday Clubland Q&A. We will have all kinds of things over the weekend. We've got a little bit of Tal Bachman, because a lot of people like a little bit of Tal Bachman. In fact, they'd like to have a lot more of Tal Bachman, so we will be doing our best to supply that demand. We'll have Mark Stein's Passing Parade. We'll have a weekend show for you. We'll have movies and music and more. And we will also get to work on Civilizational Collapse, the musical, because that is what they call a hit idea. But thank you for coming on this voyage with us these last 4 years. I thank all club members in every corner of God's earth, and we will see you again next time.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.